Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you who don't know shit about one or the other topic, I'm the People's Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I am the movie guy. We're here to... you're just doing this where now I'm started off wrong-footed every time. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Most of the time, these days, we're not even trying.
Not even remotely. Today, we're on to probably part 7 of our latest miniseries, Comfort Food Movies. Through this miniseries, we've been talking to some friends and some colleagues about their comfort food movies and comfort food beverages. And today, we have another wine beverage professional to do exactly that.
That's right. For today's episode, we welcome sommelier extraordinaire, wine salesperson, rock climber, Reiki pet practitioner, and my pandemic pal, Stephanie Schwartz, to the show.
Oh, hi, Jamie.
Hey, hey.
You say my pandemic pal, and it makes me think of, like, I don't know, when you guys were kids, did you have, like, My Pet Monster? Like, I'm imagining this is, like, Stephanie is, like, something that, like, Jamie got from a toy store. It's My Pandemic Pal, and it's something that single people who lived alone
That's exactly what it was.
That's 100% what that was.
Oh. Were you guys not buddies before lockdown?
No. So, Steph is part of the Summation crew, brought together by Anna Christina, and... I think the first time we met was that first Zoom with the five of us trying to figure out what we were doing because we needed to do anything at all.
Something.
So getting back into it, today we are going to start with beverages and go into movies because you, Steph, are a wine professional.
Yes.
Steph, when I asked you about your comfort beverage, you had... Like, you had options for the movies. You didn't have options for the beverage. It was just a category. And what was it?
Yeah. Sparkling wine.
Bubbles.
I love sparkling wine. But at the end of the day, when I'm go for sparkling wine, champagne's wonderful. Champagne's great. But I don't want something, like all beverage professionals, I don't necessarily want something that I have to sit and think about. So I usually go for something that is less intensive. I go for like dry Prosecco or Cava or even like a Franciacorta. I like something that's going to be dry and crisp and vibrant and just absolutely delightful.
So what is, while we watch Scott try to get himself in focus on the camera, which is very, very entertaining.
I'm trying not to make a spectacle of myself, but I fell out of focus. I was listening. I'm sorry.
What wine, specific wine, are we going with for this episode?
For this episode, I went with a Corpinot. It is by Canfagius, and their current release is 2013.
Because you decided on Canfagius, which is difficult to source in Pennsylvania, Scott and I both have different wines.
Oh, it's one of these again.
So
surprise!
Pennsylvania.
But it also allows us to talk a little bit about the annoyingness of the Cava Dio and wine appellations, generally speaking, which is always fun to talk about. So I am drinking Avino Cava Brut Reserva. Scotty has a Corpinot, the Kastelroig.
Can someone say all these words that are on the Castle Roy Van de Terreur? Is this the wine of Earth?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
The actual producer is called Sabate y Coca. Castle Roy is their entry level label.
And a Corpinot, that is the grape.
No.
That is the region.
That, well, it's complicated and we're going to get into
it. Damn it. I hate when it's complicated.
I am so pleased with this because earlier this week I listened to your episode with Jill and Harry Potter, and I heard you guys go on your little tangent about champagne and sparkling wine, and I just got so excited to drag this back up.
Yep.
That is wonderful. Yeah, I mean, anybody who comes on the show, a good bit of due diligence is just listen to one episode at least. And then you'll find at least 10 things that Jamie and I argued like cats and dogs about. And then just come on in and, you know.
Just lob a grenade in between us and we'll start back away
and see what happens. All right. Well, so we're all drinking different things. Steph, on the movie side of things, so this miniseries has been all over the place. What did you have us watch for today?
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Rocky
the
Horror.
The one and only.
Picture
the
show.
One and the. Only. Which version did you watch? I have to ask.
Tim Curry, obviously.
No. On the Blu-ray, when I plugged it in or dropped it in, mm-hmm. it said select US version or UK version.
Okay. Ooh. So I do the UK version.
Right, because it has that extra song.
It has the extra song, and that's the version that they do during the live showings.
Oh, okay, right. So, like for the Shadowcast version, so yeah. We show the UK one. Interesting.
Which song is
Superheroes?
Superhero, the one right at the end after the house takes off.
And Superheroes.
Yep. So I missed that one on my rewatch.
Yeah, I didn't find an answer for why Superhero is not included in the US version. I would just imagine that the movie was not thought to be a moneymaker, and they thought, well, the plot's over. Let's cut 5 minutes and wrap it up.
Oh, and on the DVD, I don't know if this is on the Blu-ray because I have the DVD. There is another little special feature that you can do where this is a little homage to the Wizard of Oz, where mm-hmm. the beginning is going to be in all black and white until they go into the main dance hall in the Time Warp, and that's where it pops into color.
That's pretty cool.
That's a good one. Well, for the folks listening at home, we watched 1975's truly iconic cult classic, The Rocky Horror Picture Show. As of this recording, you can watch Rocky Horror on Hulu in the U.S. And if you're in many other markets around the world, you can watch it on Disney Plus, which always tickles me when things that are even remotely subversive end up on the Mouse streaming channel.
Hey, Frankenfurter's officially a Disney princess.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yes,
that's so good. Yeah, except in America. In the US, Frankenfurter is a Hulu princess.
Yes.
That's so good. All right, I cannot wait to talk about the movie, but I guess we should do wine times first, right?
Yeah, James? Yeah, we're going to talk about wine.
Let's get angry about the Cavadio real quick.
Oh my God, it's going to be really good. So, Scotty, mm-hmm. we find ourselves once again in the region of Penedès, northeast Spain.
Of course, I am familiar with this region and with its wine products.
From the entire miniseries that we did on Spain. I recall we drank the Can Sumoy Pet Nat of Shirello.
Mm. Nice.
Which Scott hated.
Scott
uniformly hated all of the wines from the Spain miniseries, but that one he was particularly vitriolic about.
That was a weird miniseries. I pick a bunch of lovely family films to watch with your kids, and Jamie picks a bunch of nasty Spanish wine.
I did lean natural in my selections for that miniseries. I do believe, Scott, that you're going to like this wine, but we'll see. The reason I bring up Can Sumoy is that it's made by the Raventós family, which is sort of central to the story we're about to tell. And not to like belabor it too much, but we're talking about Cava. Cava is like the original sparkling DO mm-hmm. of Spain, or Appalachian, Scott. One of the historic problems with Cava is that it doesn't necessarily say anything about the place that it was grown.
Right. It's one of the only, or maybe the only, like DO or like delimited thing in wine that it just says, no, we're just protecting the style, not the actual place that it comes from.
Correct. So while something like 90% of all cava comes from Penedès, it can be made in Extremadura or Galicia or Castilla y León or Castilla La Mancha. It's just kind of anywhere in Spain you can make cava. And it can be made from basically any grape. And this led to the second problem, which is a wild swing in quality and the cava DO basically meaning nothing at all.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure, Steph, you can relate your time on the floor. Like when you start talking cava to people, either they like have a specific memory of one that they like, or they're like, oh, that like that stuff that goes with orange juice in a mimosa.
Right. And just to like relate to another sparkling wine region that's doing the same thing that like the Corpanado is doing in Cava, like a lot of people have the same associations with Prosecco of it is this wine. It is used for cocktails and mimosas. And sometimes it's not really that good, and or it's like too sweet or something. And it's so like then to see it in a restaurant on a wine list and to command, especially like in New York City, to command like a certain price point, people are just kind of like, eh, no thanks.
Yep. And so in response, the producers of Cava, or many of them, decided to break off. It gets even more complicated, Scott. You're going to love this.
Am I?
No, you're not.
No, okay. You're not.
Because I hate it.
Okay. Okay, good.
And it doesn't matter how you feel about it, Scott. You're going to hate this in solidarity with Jamie regardless.
That has not historically been how I feel about things that Jamie hates.
Scott likes the things that make me upset, unless they also make him upset for separate reasons.
Exactly.
I think this will make him upset for separate reasons, so there will still be a solidarity of the hate.
Yeah, I agree with that. So the first producer to break off from the Cavadillo was the aforementioned Raventós family. Raventós y Blanc created their own appellation called Conca del Rio Anoia, which sticks in my brain because I find it annoying. They are
What do you find annoying? Do you find the words?
Well, I mean, it's called Anoia and it's annoying, but also it's annoying that only one producer claims this appellation on their label. It is only Raventós y Blanc that prints Conca del Rio Anoia on their labels. It is effectively meaningless, especially for a brand that is recognizable with whatever appellation is on their label.
What is the virtue of this for them being the only one with that appellation? Why does that help them? Does it make them feel exclusive in some way? Is this a dumb legal thing?
They don't want to be associated with producers, Cava producers that they deem lower quality. They're trying to set themselves apart.
Okay.
So a differentiation.
All right. More of a differentiation than just like putting their own specific name on the label. That's not enough. They also have to have, their own
appellation with its own specific requirements that they set for themselves.
Okay, cool. That's dumb, but okay, fine. We're the only ones who do it exactly the way that we do. And anybody else who does it this way has to do it our way, but nobody else does it. It's like tying your hand behind your back.
Yeah, it's, you know, it just feels like them jerking themselves off. Like, as I said, they were already the most recognizable quality-oriented Cava brand. And there was, like, effectively was no reason other than to give a middle finger to the rest of Cava to break off. And it's exceptionally annoying because there only one fucking producer does it.
And I'm sorry, how did they break off? Because the appellations are in Europe, it's a legally controlled thing, right? Mm-hmm. They petitioned the
Spanish government and the EU government to recognize them and created their own what's called in Spain mm-hmm. Consejo Regulador, which is a council of regulations, and they are the ones in charge of it.
Okay.
Because they're the only members.
You were correct. I find this annoying. Yeah. This is dumb. I don't care that it annoys Jamie. If Jamie was on board with it, I would still be annoyed by this. This is just arbitrary and a waste of European taxpayers' time and money. And yeah, this is dumb.
That is 100% correct, Scott. So that happened in 2012. Then in 2013, another group of producers, 17 of them this time, decided to break off.
It's not that the Corbinot's not, it's not that many.
Haven't gotten to Corbinot yet, Steph. You forgot about Classic Penedès.
Classic Penedès, always sneaking in there under the radar.
You know what? Forgetting about Classic Penedès, how classic. Oh, this is so great shit. Because whenever I say dumb things now, I can see Jamie's reaction instead of just like feeling the angry energy at my pun.
All right. Well, Jamie, I obviously know about Classic Penedès. Our guest's sake, could you please explain whatever it is happened with Classic Penedès and why they're not classic anymore?
Well, they're still classic and they're still producing wine, but as is indicated by Steph's completely having forgotten them, they don't really enter the US market very often. Not a ton of it is made. As I said, there are only 17 producers, and who then got eclipsed by Corpinot later on. But in 2013, these 17 producers split off. They decided that in order to have the classic Penedès label, you have to grow organic grapes. You have to have a focus on indigenous varieties, but they continued to allow international varieties like Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, Riesling, Pinot Noir, this like stuff that is explicitly allowable in Cava, that sort of started this whole conversation. People want the traditional varieties of Catalonia. They then required a little bit more aging, 15 months of aging. Of all of these appellations, Classic Penedès is actually the smallest geographic region, encompassing only 4,000 hectares with three subzones. And I've never seen a bottle of it. I don't know any producers. I just know that it exists and that it's stupid. Then, in 2015, four producers, which would have eventually grow to the 11 members that are today, started Corpinot, which means Heart of the Penedès. They mandate organic viticulture, only indigenous grapes. And we're going to get to something that I learned today that is annoying about one of the wines in our lineup. And there are seven subzones. And Corpinot is the one that has been given any attention by the wine community here in the US. And as far as I can tell, the wine community also in the UK.
Yeah, it's kind of like how a group of champagne producers might inform their little special club for whatever reasons they wanted to. But these guys are like, no, we're going to form our own group. Like, we want to leave the deal. We don't necessarily want to be associated with these lower quality Cava producers. We want to raise the standards. We are our own little thing.
But they weren't doing anything different, right? It's not like they split off and then upped their game and changed their methodology. It's just branding is what this sounds like.
It's like, we're all doing these same things, like organic viticulture. We're using grapes that are native to the area. Our wines are better quality and more classic to the region. So let's differentiate ourselves. Let's form our own little group. And the producers that started Corpinot, they didn't make it so like no one else could join. Because was it Jamie said there's like five or seven original producers?
I thought four, but you are probably right.
And now it's up to 11. So like other producers can join the
six producers. Sorry, I misspoke.
So the actual number is our average of what we thought it was.
Very diplomatic. So,
but now there are 11 producers total in the Corpinot. So other producers can join it if they would like to, as long as they adhere to the requirements and parameters that the originals have laid out and whatever changes that they have as a group decided.
Okay. The other thing is like a desire to be a part of this group. And there are two producers off the top of my head. One of them is in a bottle next to me that abide by all of the rules and regulations of Corpinot, but still prefer to label as Cava because they've decided they want to help raise the bar in the Cava Dio. So there's this like, there are lines in the sand all over the place, and a bunch of Catalan people are mad at each other.
That sounds right.
This is so dumb. This might be dumber than, well, not any of the French appellation laws and things that we've talked about. This isn't as dumb as the thing with the, what was it? Le Cigar Blanc, where it's a UFO. And they put laws about crop circles or some shit on the books in the EU.
Steph, you know about this. There is a regulation on the books in Châteauneuf-du-Pape that prohibits the landing of UFOs in the area.
And do you think the aliens are going to give a shit about this?
Exactly.
I mean, they heard it was like, the best place to grow fucking Bordeaux, so they had to come. It's the best place in the quadrant.
Well, so the reason that this is...
There are so many things wrong with that statement.
So many things wrong.
All of the nouns that I used were incorrect. I'm aware.
I don't actually remember why the law got put on the books, but I do know that the reason Scott and I talked about it was we did an episode on Bonnie Doon's Le Cigar Blanc. And Randall Graham, in in a funny way, decided to put UFOs on his Le Cigar labels because he's...
Of course he did.
Because he's that guy.
He was the Roan Ranger, right?
He's one of the Roan Rangers.
Yes. He was one of the originals, man.
You remember things.
I remembered the Roan Ranger. I remember the dumbest shit that we talk about. Not anything useful at all.
Hey, it's the dumbest shit that's going to get you to win trivia, so it's okay.
That's also fair.
I don't know. I've never seen a lot of wine trivia at bar quizzo nights.
If there was, I would win more trivia nights.
Mm-hmm. Wait, quick, also, Jamie, if I ever quiz, how many producers originally split off from the Cava Dio to make the Corbinet?
Six.
Six.
All right, you're good to go this time. Anyway, this is yummy. I don't know what the hell you guys are drinking, but this is pretty good. This is nice.
Oh, I love the wine that I have. It's so delightful.
So I've got a couple of questions for you, Steph. And
okay.
We'll talk about what each of us has in our glass just and whether or not we're enjoying it. The first question before we get into the wine you're drinking specifically is what's your take on all of this nonsense going on in the Cava Dio and all of these producers doing all of their things? And like, do you even find any of it to be useful or do you just look for producers?
I think it's more useful for the producers and for us as wine professionals to have this information. Because the average consumer doesn't have any idea, nor do they really, they just don't know what the Corbinet is. I don't think that it's necessarily that they wouldn't care or don't care. They just don't know. So like having, you know, like Recaredo or Camfasia, so like even Reventos on a wine list or on the shelves in a wine shop, it's going to get lumped in with Cava because what else are we going to do with it? Mm-hmm. Those are really my only thoughts on it. Like, I think the wines are great. And it's the same with kind of with any region, any style. You're still going to have variation from producer to producer, and you have to drink a lot to find out what you like. So find the producers that you like, stick with them. When you find out that you love Reventos and you want to try something else, talk to the wine professional at the restaurant, talk to the people at your wine shop to find something that'll be similar enough, but and also different enough to get you a little bit out of your comfort zone and try different things.
Yeah, unless you live in Pennsylvania, then don't talk to the people in your wine shop because they don't know anything about wine.
No, if you live in Pennsylvania, talk to Jamie.
Thank you, Steph.
Or also, Carrie. Talk to Jamie or Carrie.
Or yes. Carrie. All right. Well, don't talk to the people in the wine shops because there aren't any anymore because Jamie burned them all down.
I did not. There was significant looting and they were closed for much of last week as a result of that.
Jamie, what did you do?
I didn't do anything. There were riots because of a court decision to stop pursuing charges for a cop that killed someone in cold blood, because that's how we do here in America.
What are you talking about? That's never once.
Stop it, Scott. You can't.
I can't.
And then there was a bunch of looting in and around Center City, and a couple of PLCB stores got hit. And as a result, the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board deemed it necessary to close every store statewide.
Wow.
That sounds like a really bad decision.
Yeah, that's a huge overreaction.
Yep. Uh-huh.
What, did they think the looting was going to spread? Or was it like in Salt? Was it like their mourning? Like that's their version of like flag at half mast?
All I can, my only response to anything that they do is that they're drooling morons and they need to be removed from power.
So is the temperance moving starting up again in Pennsylvania? That's what I'm hearing.
No, it is not.
It's absolutely not.
I feel like this is starting a whole other conversation. Let's go back to wine and Rocky Horror. The Rocky Horror Cava Show. Let's go.
Yes. Okay. So
episode title done. Thank you so much, Steph. We always struggle with a
so
sweaty
welcome.
Pun to try and fit the drink name into it.
Let's write
Rocky
it
Horror
down.
Cava Show. Perfect. Love it.
I've been thinking about this for like 3 days. So we're good. I have your puns.
Okay.
Love it.
Tell us a little bit about the wine in your glass, Steph.
Okay. So I'm drinking Canfasius. Canfasius is this historic estate that's been around forever, but like modern history, the Huguet family purchased this estate in 1945. So they are near the Montserrat Pinnacle in Penedès, which is kind of in the northern boundary. It's the farthest away from the Mediterranean. They're 400 meters in elevation. So when we're thinking about this region, they're much more of a continental climate than having some kind of maritime influence. And what that, for our non-wine drinkers, what that means, a continental climate is when you're getting a lot of extremes in temperature variation. Your summers are really hot. Your winters are really cold because you don't have water around to help regulate the climate. So that's where they're located, because they are part of the Corpinat. They are 100% organic. They are still to this day family owned and operated. They're smaller production. They only make about 6,000 cases of wine a year. So not a whole lot. And I am drinking their Corpinat, which this might be, I think I know the thing that's pissing Jamie off about this. The wine is mostly Terroir and Macabeo. They do have a little bit of Pinot Noir in here.
Mm. Oh, there's a little Pinot Noir in your wine.
I love Pinot Noir.
There's a little Chardonnay in Scott's wine, and there is none of either in my cava.
Why would the presence of Pinot Noir piss Jamie off? I don't understand.
If you remember back about 5 minutes, I do not. One of the things about Corpinat is only indigenous varieties.
Oh, right. And this is their whole, they fucking peeled off and did their own thing. Uh-huh. And then they're putting Pinot Noir in there, which everyone knows is not indigenous to that region of Spain.
That's right. Everyone knows that.
Everyone in this discussion knows that now.
Whatever questions you may have about that, I do not have answers.
I have no follow-up questions.
I find it funny that on the tech sheets for both of those Corpinats, it says that there are, that in your case, Steph, Pinot Noir, and Scott's Chardonnay, just like ignoring the fact that Corpinat is for indigenous varieties only. Weird to me. I don't know. I'm sure the Canfagus is delicious. I haven't had the pleasure of tasting that particular producer.
And another thing, just we're going to go back to this producer being awesome. I'm drinking their 2013 vintage, which is the current release.
Oh.
Right? And it's so fresh. It's so vibrant. In my very humble, blasphemous wine nerd opinion, especially when we're looking at value wine, this wine punches way above its weight class. Like, it should be more expensive than it is. It's just fucking beautiful. You get some of those really beautiful brioche savory notes that are going on, and it's still at the same time so vibrant and fresh. And it's just an absolute delight.
How expensive is it?
It is under, I'm going to double check.
I think I saw it for like $40 retail.
For a bottle that's aged 10 years before it even goes to market.
Yeah.
That does right? not feel intuitive to me.
It's that, not.
Yeah. So like they're always like sitting in the cellar for 10 years before they put them out.
They hold on to their stuff. Yeah.
There are a number of producers out there who have the, we'll call it privilege and the inclination to do this kind of thing. You know, places that have been in operation for a very long time that have a significant amount of storage space, and not a ton of storage cost, that can do it and see the value in releasing fully mature wines. Another one that springs to mind that's also Spanish is Lopez de Heredia.
Yeah, they hold on to their stuff for a long time. And that's always been their thing. So I think if you were starting off as a producer, there's no way you would be able to do that. But just like both of these producers, like Lopez that you just mentioned, Canfagus, they've been around for so long. Canfagus has been in continuous production since the 1600s. Wow. So they just have this history and they just have these stores. So when it was purchased by the Huguet family, they were able to just do that.
And it's good. You like it. You're down with the wine. You seem pretty enthusiastic about it.
I'm so enthusiastic about this wine. It's so good. I just want to drink it all the time.
Do you have a stockpile? Do you have a couple bottles on the rack behind you there?
Always.
Always of this particular, you got a couple more of the 2013 ready to go?
Absolutely.
Nice. It's good to have a favorite. that's ready to roll. Your house white or your house whatever, house cava, house whatever the hell these idiots in Spain are calling it.
Mojo Jojo Casa House.
Yes.
Mojo Jojo Cava House.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's very good.
So, Scott, what do you think about the wine in your glass?
Well, it has bubbles.
Yep.
It is crisp. I'm enjoying the crispness. There's like a yeasty thing going on. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a ripe apple kind of thing going on. Very sweet. There's a nose thing that I can't place. I don't know quite what this scent is, but it's intriguing to me. But overall, I'm grooving on it. Like, I'm halfway through my second glass. I'm probably going to get myself into trouble with this one. It's super tasty. And there is Chardonnay in it.
There is. There's a little bit of Chardonnay. Maybe that's
why. You know how I like me a Chardonnay.
I do. It's only a little bit of Chardonnay.
How do you feel about that Chardonnay and that wine?
I feel like it's an abandonment of their principles, but I also don't care that much. Like, the only reason I care is that they cared to put a new fucking appellation together based on this thing and then turned around and were like, but except for this little bit of Chardonnay.
Yeah, you're tying yourself up in knots here, because on the one hand, you're annoyed that they abandon their principles, but on the other, you think their principles are bullshit to begin with.
Exactly.
And you can't decide which bothers you more. Which would bother you more, if they didn't put the Chardonnay in it and adhered to their principles, which are bullshit, or if they did put the Chardonnay in it and didn't have such strict arbitrary principles that they imposed upon themselves?
I think both of those scenarios are preferable to what has happened, which is state these principles and then immediately put Chardonnay in your damn fucking bottle.
But are we surprised at Jimmy being so contradictory in what he's angry about?
Absolutely. Not even remotely. Jamie's just mad because these people, in their need to separate their own DO appellation, whatever, are being more iconoclastic than Jamie is in his professional
Fuck you,
life.
Buddy. God, I hate you. I hate you so much.
We love you, Jamie.
Oh.
I am drinking a bottle that is labeled cava, that is organic, aged for 18 months, and is only Shirello, Macabeo, and Parellada, which I just find funny. Avino has been a producer that I've loved for a long, long time. In full disclosure, I'm currently pouring it at Southwark by the glass. It's one of those that's like, it's not SpawnCon.
Sounds like it.
It's not SpawnCon.
It sounds like you're scratching one hand with the other or something.
Well, I mean, if anyone wants to come see me at Southwark, I'm there Monday nights.
Fucking SpawnCon. It's all getting cut out of the show.
So anyways, Jamie, talk about your wine.
So Avino, a great producer. I was actually first introduced to them from their pet nat called Petillon. That's 100% Malvasia. That is just like floral and joyful. And it's like, if a Moscato d'Asti was totally dry, that's that. And it's amazing. And it's like $15 a bottle retail. And if you find it, you should buy it. And this Cava Brut Reserve is like 20 to 22 on a shelf. And similarly, like this is scratching the like comfort wine itch for me also, Steph. Like it's uncomplicated enough where I'm not really like analyzing it, but it has enough about it where I feel like I'm drinking a real wine.
Yeah. That's exactly what we want out of like an end of day, end of work day, sparkling wine.
100%. So moving on to a couple of questions, let's talk about comfort food, Steph.
Okay. You know, comfort food.
We've like talked about it with a number of our guests. It's the whole reason why we're doing this mini series. So let's start with food. What are the foods that like after a long challenging day or like week or month or whatever that you like return to sort of center yourself?
Oh gosh. Macaroni and cheese or fried chicken.
Mac and cheese
is where it's at.
Chicken nuggies, chicken tendies. And when I say macaroni and cheese, I mean Kraft macaroni and cheese.
That's the Blue Box Blues.
I have upgraded to, was it Aunt Annie's?
Annie's is good.
I've upgraded to that. I'm spending a little bit more money on a slightly higher quality powdered cheese product.
It's organic, Steph.
As I said, slightly higher quality powdered cheese product. But yeah, that's my comfort. Those two things are huge, huge comfort food items for me.
And mac and cheese. No, I want mac and cheese.
They're also really good with sparkling wine.
Yeah. I mean, fried chicken and champagne is a well-known thing in wine circles. Sparkling wine for me goes with fucking everything. Scott's heard me say this a lot over the course of this podcast.
Absolutely.
But sparkling wine and mac and cheese, that sounds wonderful.
I guess
really anything in mac and cheese sounds great, but sparkling wine also very good.
I would not love Barolo and mac and cheese. That sounds not good.
Okay, fair.
Even though it's not my preferred style of wine to drink, a full-bodied buttery Chardonnay and mac and cheese really hits the spot.
That's hitting you on all of those like opulence receptors.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like the fattiest, highest alcohol, all of the vices.
It's rich. It's matching that rich decadence of macaroni and cheese and that rich decadence of that full-bodied Chardonnay. Just like, we're not going to contrast anything here. We just want to match weight with weight, opulence with opulence. Let's fucking go. It's going to be great.
100%. So, next question. In beverages generally, not speaking about comfort beverages, when you are out for a drink or you're pouring yourself something at home, what do you look for like pleasure in a beverage? What are the things that you like?
Good question. Let's see. If I'm at home, I don't necessarily want to think too much about it. I'm at home. I want to chill. I don't want to think. So I'm looking for something that isn't too complex. I want something simple, austere. My palate enjoys things that are dry with high acid. If I'm going out and I'm having a cocktail, or if I'm going to make a cocktail at home, I'm looking for a little bit more complexity. I want a deep richness in flavors. I want things to be balanced with sugar and acid. And depending on what kind of mood I'm in, I want some opulence. Like one of my favorite cocktails is, I love a Manhattan. I find them to be absolutely beautiful. You have some beautiful balance there. You have a little bit of sugar going on. You have all of these beautiful vanilla flavors and just the opulence, the weight, the richness. Gorgeous.
Yeah. I love a Manhattan.
I love a Manhattan.
Jamie, like, make us some Manhattans right now, please.
Well, unfortunately, Scott, you are an hour by car from me, an hour 15. And I could honestly probably get to New York City quicker than that.
That's not true.
It's an hour by train.
Yeah, but you'd have to get to the train station.
That's fair. And whatever. And then Steph lives in Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah.
Jamie, what are you... Where's your train stop? I'll meet you. I'll find Penn Station. It'll be fine. Let's
meet him there, because last time Jamie and I went to Brooklyn from Penn Station, Jamie got us lost three times.
I'm
from New York. I'm Jamie. I'm from New York. It's lost three times between Penn Station and Brooklyn.
Twice in Brooklyn and once in Manhattan.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Twice in Brooklyn. Once in Manhattan.
I'll tell you guys where to go in Manhattan that's close to Penn Station and meet you there.
Sounds great.
Sounds wonderful.
And we'll have some Manhattans. Although Manhattans in that neighborhood of Manhattan are going to run us a pretty penny.
Okay, so if we're going to have Manhattans in Manhattan and be charged a pretty penny, we're going to have to leave that neighborhood.
Yeah.
I'll take you elsewhere.
All right.
We'll go a little farther downtown. Actually.
I can follow directions. Absolutely. I will not get lost. Jamie, Mr. I'm a New Yorker. I lived here when I was four. We'll get us lost.
Moving right along. I think we've got a good idea of what gets you excited beverage wise. I love that you cite a Manhattan, because that really like dials it in. Like all of the flavors dialed up. All of that like visceral joy sort of to the front. That's what a Manhattan is to me. A question, a very thoughtful question that Scott has been asking of folks with regard to the comfort movies that they have is, is about memories. So, Steph, talk to me about some memories that you have surrounding sparkling wine.
Well, I will give a lot of credit to the CIVC on this with their brilliant marketing of champagne being a celebratory beverage. It is luxury. It's for celebration. It's for the holidays. So I think growing up and seeing that, and before I knew about wine, what before I knew what I know now, it's like, I love champagne. What do you have like from Spain? Or do you have any Prosecco? Like people making that association. I think the CIVC did a wonderful job of marketing champagne like that. And now just all sparkling wine kind of has that association. Sparkling wine is for celebrating. And why not celebrate every single day?
Damn right.
It's what today's a Wednesday. Let's celebrate a Wednesday. We've made it through. We're halfway through the work week. Let's go. We got this. Champagne or sparkling wine for birthdays. I'm planning a divorce party for my best friend. We're like sparkling wine for that. Let's have sparkling wine for weddings, sparkling wine for graduations, sparkling wine because it's a fucking Friday. Like let's go. It's wonderful. I think sparkling wine as a category still needs a lot of work with not wine people to be viewed as it can also be an everyday wine. But I also think every day should be celebrated.
Yeah, as resident not wine person here, that is my association of sparkling as well, is that it's in some way celebratory. And that's all just bleed over from, I'm sorry, what was that acronym, the CAVC, CIVC?
CIVC, and this is the governing body of the region of Champagne.
Got it. Okay. So yeah, you're saying that this is like spillover from that very excellent and ubiquitous marketing campaign, that it's celebration and therefore you can splurge a little bit, but then because you're splurging for that, you don't want to do that every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm down with that. But bubbles whenever you feel like it. It's a Wednesday night. My child is downstairs. I have to do bedtime in 47 minutes. I'm going to drink more of this bottle. Let's do it. We're having a good time. I concur.
Yeah. So having answered that question about your associations with sparkling wine, we need to devote ample time to the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
The Rocky Horror Cava, or the Rocky Cava Picture Show. I fucked it up already.
It's Rocky Cava Picture Show? I thought it was Rocky Horror Cava Show.
No, Cava fits in better with horror than it does with picture. Rocky Cava Picture Show. Isn't that what you said initially?
I said the Rocky Horror Cava Show, but we can debate this behind the scenes.
Well, let's get into it. I don't know how much context anyone listening actually needs for this movie, but like, what the hell? Let's just do it. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, a 1975 feature film directed by Jim Sharman with a screenplay by Sharman and Richard O'Brien based on the stage musical, The Rocky Horror Show, music, book, and lyrics by O'Brien and directed by Sharman. Susan Sarandon and Barry Bostwick played newly engaged milquetoast American stiffs Janet and Brad, who, thanks to an unfortunate flat tire, find themselves at the spooky castle home of Dr. Frankenfurter, a truly delicious Tim Curry performance. So Janet and Brad are milquetoast heroes. They attempt to fend off the initially unwanted advances of their host and his coterie of horned-up proto-goth-punk weirdo servants, maybe aliens, including writer Richard O'Brien as Riff Raff, who is like clearly like an Igor stand-in in like a Frankenstein story. Patricia Quinn is the squeaky-voiced domestic Magenta. Peter Hinwood as the titular himbo, Frankenfurter's monster, and then Meatloaf shows up for one show-stopping number as biker and sax solo enthusiast Eddie. And then like halfway through, we just kind of forget about Brad and Janet and they become like part of the background chorus and Tim Curry completely fucking takes over the movie.
I think this might've been Tim Curry's breakout performance in film.
It's definitely his first like big screen performance. Yeah. He played Frankenfurter in the British production, the original stage production of the musical. And he was like him and a handful of the rest of the cast were brought on for the American version or for the feature film. But then the American financiers insisted on American stars for Brad and Janet, which is where Sarandon and Bostwick come in.
So fun little facts that I've learned over the years, right? So the American premiere of the stage production, Meatloaf, he was hired for that because he was the only actor who could get through the character's signature number, Hot Patootie. And he played Eddie and Dr. Scott in that stage production.
Did he really?
Interesting. That's interesting.
Right? Huh.
I would love to see that. Like him as Dr. Scott. Amazing.
Right? Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. I gotta switch it on here. My boy Meatloaf in the background. I love me a sax solo. I was heartbroken when Meatloaf only survived one fucking scene in the movie. Like, oh, Meatloaf's got the juice here. Where's he going? Come back, Meatloaf.
He's getting killed. He's getting a murder. He's getting
totally killed off screen. Yeah, my wife and I were talking about it before we recorded, because this is confession time. I had never seen this movie before. I was convinced that I had seen it before. My wife and I, many years ago, like 15 years ago, we went to see up in New Hope near us. We went to see a live production of the musical with audience callbacks from like the shadow cast version of the movie.
Shock has subdued now.
Yeah. So like I had seen that and I've heard enough of the songs in like truly horrifically embarrassing karaoke performances over the years that I think in my brain, standard. I just thought I had seen the movie. What?
I said standard. That's a very standard. Like we get up there and do drunken renditions of Rocky Horror songs at karaoke.
I have to say. The movie, dig all the songs. I love karaoke. I don't think people should do the songs from this movie at karaoke at all.
I agree with you.
The movie starts up.
Hot Patootie is a great karaoke song. What are you talking about?
I have weird feelings about show tunes as karaoke songs because like you can do a pop song and the people watching you, they don't need any additional context. It's just the song start to finish. But like if you go up and you sing Touch Me, without any context, if like I hadn't seen it in so long since the last time I had seen someone do this at karaoke, it's like, all right, I get it. It's Rocky Horror, but like, this is a very, like, this song is perfect in the context of the whole show. And on a stage, it's just like, you are absolutely murdering this. And I don't understand emotionally what's happening here. Oh boy. I'm going to save my opinions about the picture itself until we hear from you a little bit, Steph, but
all right. Yeah. Got some questions. Shoot.
Yes. So describe for us your first ever experience seeing this movie as best you can recall it. I need the where, the when, the how old, the with whom, and any other salient details you recall.
So I was in high school, 16 years old. And my best friend, this is the girl I'm going to see in Florida in a couple weeks. She was like, hey, do you want to go to this live showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show? It's playing at this, I grew up in small town, Florida, USA. It's like, it's playing at this local theater. Do you want to go? It's like, well, I've never seen it. She's like, oh my gosh, you've never seen the movie. Like, you should go. Like, let's go do this. So for the live showings, you had to be at least 16 years old.
Ah, okay.
So this is what they would only do this around Halloween. So the first time I saw the movie was with the shadow cast for my 16th birthday with my best friend, Laura. We were at a cross country meet during the day in like an hour or 2 hour drive away or something like that. Cause it was like a regional, whatever meet. And my parents, like we took the bus down, my parents drove down to see the meet and then they drove the two of us to the theater so we could go see it. And they stayed in the car while we did Rocky Horror. That was my first time seeing the movie with the shadow cast.
Did they put the red V on your forehead? Cause it was your first time.
Well, we were, 16 years old and chicken shit. So we did not out ourselves as virgins.
Ah, okay. I got that at the live show that we went to and I was very concerned that they were going to somehow drag me on stage and incorporate my Rocky Horror virginity into the production. And blessedly, there were dozens and dozens of us in the house that night who had the red V on their forehead. So I was off the hook.
There's always dozens who get the red V. But as I continue to go to Shadowcast showings, there is sometimes a ritual in which those who are branded with the red V do get roped into the show, the pre-show. And I have seen lap dance contests, or two people that don't know each other. you can't use your hands, but here's a balloon and you have to bust it. Use your imagination on what happens. fake orgasm contests. So sometimes, yes, those with the scarlet V do get roped into the show in that way.
Glad I was spared that. What did your folks think about, like, dropping you off for 97 minutes of Rocky Horror and then coming to pick you back up and you are 16 years old?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
We've never had that conversation.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know if they knew what it was or this, that. They're like, I have no idea. They might have, because my mom, I did want a garter belt after seeing that. And I did go shopping with my mom for my very first garter belt. So maybe they had an idea. I'm not sure.
They were maybe being a little willfully ignorant on that.
Yeah.
Potentially. Sorry, mom. Sorry, dad, if you're listening to this.
They almost certainly are not.
You know what's funny is like, and I asked what your parents thought, not to be like, oh, were your parents like super pissed that you went to this, you know, super transgressive show? But like, I know the movie and the show's reputation like is what it is, that it was, you know, barrier breaking and it was this way, especially like the midnight shows and the shadow cast for a lot of people who at the time especially were like living in the closet and were not able to feel any kind of like sense of their own truth to come out and have a sense of community. And watching it this morning, honestly, I was like shocked at how, and maybe this is just the 2023 of it all, but like nothing about it felt transgressive to me. It all felt so positive and affirming. And you know, like Tim Curry walks out and like, and you know, when I was 16, if I had seen it, I would have been like scandalized. And watching it now, I'm like, fuck yeah, Tim Curry, you're having a great time. You look hot. Look at your shoulders. Look at that thigh hair. You're having a great time.
Right?
The only thing that shocked or scandalized me watching it, I was devastated by the murder of Eddie, and it happened off screen and is basically not violent. I was truly shocked by that. And everything else was like, yeah, they're okay. They're aliens. Fine. Go back to your home planet.
Like, yeah. It's kind of like everything's fine.
Yeah.
Nothing to see here. Continue on with your day.
It's whatever.
Can I just say Tim Curry's makeup?
Oh,
so fucking good. Unbelievable. Wig.
The makeup is incredible. The makeup is an icon. The wig
is also excellent.
Yeah. As someone who, like Jamie, I shouldn't call you out. I shouldn't put you on blast.
It's
as
fine. Someone, I'm losing my hair.
Right. As someone who is losing their hair rapidly, and I just had like a lengthy conversation with my barber the other day about like options and like talking about the shape of my head and shape of my face, the wig that Tim Curry wears is so incredibly flattering to the shape of his face.
So
like that
God.
Wig is ridiculous and he looks amazing in it. It looks so good.
It's so good.
These are the kinds of things I think about now.
He's absolutely iconic.
Yeah. It's truly an amazing performance. I think everybody's like pretty good in the movie, but like that Tim Curry performance is an all-timer.
Tim Curry in that movie. Like when I think of this movie, I think of Tim Curry, how he looks, and holy shit, Sexual Awakening.
Yeah.
Like it's... You're not turned on by Tim Curry in this movie. What is like?
What the fuck is wrong with you?
He's just so confident and having such a good time. His smile as he like when he takes off the cape for the first time and starts strutting down. Absolute delight at the song and at the wardrobe. He's having such a good time.
He looks amazing. He feels amazing. He's so confident in who he is and what he's doing. And just, yes, please.
Yeah.
That's.
I want to go back real quick to that first experience you had watching the movie. What do you remember as like your emotional response to it? Like, because I can imagine, I mean, seeing this movie for the first time with a shadow cast being a very strange experience. It could almost be like a little bit off-putting. Like, I don't know, if it were me, I would be like, hey, everybody shut the fuck up. I want to watch the movie. Why do you keep shouting things back at the screen? That would be my personal response.
I was kind of prepped for all of that to happen during the movie. So it wasn't like, everyone shut up. Like, I can't enjoy this. It wasn't like that at all. I just remember I had a really awesome time. It was just fun. So much fun and joy. And everyone was happy. That's what I remember. Yeah.
it's a good time. I don't actually think it's a great or even good movie, but it is such a great time watching it. You know, like it is, I was trying to explain this to my wife earlier that like, I don't think it's good as a movie, but it is so singular to itself and so good at being itself, which nothing else could be. Like nothing else could be Rocky Horror. There's so few things that are even in the ballpark of what this movie is and what it does and the tones and varieties and the camp and the art style and the goth and the like constant sexuality and androgyny and celebration of all of it. It's so good at being itself that I don't mind that it's like not a great movie, like emotional experience. Like the main characters kind of disappear after a while and the plot is a bunch of like garbled together bullshit and it doesn't matter because every 2 minutes there's another fucking great song and everybody's having a great time and it's a blast. It's so much fun.
I agree with you fully there. In college, I like speech, public speaking class, do like come up to this front and we're going to like do a movie review. I did a movie review on Rocky Horror Picture Show. And my review of the movie is like, it's not a great movie, but what you should do is experience the live showings with the shadow cast. And I remember, well, first of all, part of the parameters of this project wasn't to give a positive movie review. And I remember like, you know, everyone gave like anonymous feedback to the speeches and whatnot. Someone's like, you should, when you're reviewing a movie, you shouldn't say that it's bad. I'm like, I'm not reviewing the movie. Like, first of all, I didn't think it was an amazing movie back then. Like, I just loved the experience of going to see it. And you should like, shut up, dude. Like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Oh, of course it was.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know because
it was anonymous, but we know it was a dude.
It was a dude. So he's on Twitter. So, he's very active now.
Probably a dude. I tend to use Florida dude. Man. Don't even get me started on Florida man. Florida woman needs to step her game up, but that's a whole other conversation. Next question.
Can I briefly?
Yes.
This
yes,
is not about me, but my first viewing of first. The show. Now this, I know that this part of the show is not about me, but I'm going to make it about me a little bit.
That's
just like a man.
That's very yeah, just like a man.
Just like a Jamie.
One of the things that sticks in my mind about this, about Rocky Horror, either the Shadowcast shows or the movie, is Scott, it should not surprise you to know.
Your mother loved this movie.
Of course she did.
Of course she did. Makes perfect sense.
Huge touchstone for her. I think that she saw it like right on release in 1975.
Wow.
Her you know,
and four other people.
Right.
Fair.
And so she showed it to me very young. I don't 100% remember how young I was, but like significantly pre-puberty, you know, probably like between 7 and 10, maybe earlier.
That's a bold choice, Sharon.
Well, she was a bold
That's
woman.
That's a very bold choice.
She was, yeah.
I'm into this.
And one of the things that will always stick in my head is the opening song with the floating lips talking about this the double feature science fiction picture show. When the movie concludes, I was waiting for another movie because it said double feature in the fucking beginning.
Oh man, kids are stupid. You know what? That's actually not unfair. It tells you right up front, science fiction double feature show, and then doesn't deliver.
There was not a double feature. And I remember turning around to my mom and going like, when's the next movie?
So Jamie, how mad are you at Rocky Horror for that?
I am not at all mad at Rocky Horror. And it just makes me smile because I think about my mother and her having to deal with my literal ass at like 8 years old, turning to her going, where's the next movie?
Where's the next one? Well, you know what? She brought it on herself.
She did.
She made you. You're her spawn. Steph, prior to watching it for this episode, when do you think was the last time you watched Rocky Horror? This is kind of like a thing we're trying to gauge with all of our guests. How often do you come back to your comfort food movie?
Right. So I did not rewatch this movie for this episode because I've seen it a lot. The last time I saw it was on August 19th. It was here in New York City. There's a troupe that does live showings, like twice a month. So there's some story here. So my partner, I learned that he hadn't seen Rocky Horror Picture Show. He hadn't seen a live showing before. And I'm like slightly horrified whenever someone tells me that, because I just kind of assume everyone in my circle knows and loves Rocky Horror Picture Show. Bad on me. But I learned he hadn't seen a live showing before, and it kind of turned into a mission to get him to a live showing. So another friend and I, we amassed a large group of people. There were like 25 of us in the theater. Wow. We were rolling deep. It was amazing. There were so many first timers there, and just this really beautiful mix of people that we knew from different communities, like coming together for a live showing of Rocky Horror. Sometimes this troupe does theme nights, and this one just so happened to be Barbie themed.
Of course. August of this summer. Yeah, yep. Of course.
Uh-huh. It was amazing. My costume was Ken Majors.
Well done.
Okay. I now own a fanny pack, a Ken fanny pack. It's might be the dumbest thing I've ever purchased, but I love it so much. And I had brown loafers with like frilly socks on. I went to Target and bought tidy whities and dyed a pair pink.
Perfect.
Wow.
That's great.
Oh my God. It was so good. And this is also when all the strikes were going on. And my friend Shannon will tell me I'm wrong on this, and she can shut up and let me live in my fantasy world. I'm pretty sure Kate McKinnon was playing Frankenfurter as Weird Barbie.
Like part of the shadow cast crew. That's awesome.
Yeah. So like everyone was like a Barbie character. They had Eddie being Ken, which I don't necessarily agree with that casting choice, but whatever. It's not my casting. I think Weird Barbie as Frankenfurter was amazing and beautiful.
That's
Janet was Barbie. It was amazing.
Stereotypical Barbie.
It was wonderful. Yeah, everyone was Barbie. Sense. It was so beautiful.
That's so good. Okay. So you have it like down to the date when the last time you saw the movie was, and it was at a Shadowcast live show.
Yep.
This is a two-parter question. How many times do you think, estimating you've seen the movie, but also how many times do you think you have seen it live, like with an audience and with a shadow cast?
Okay, so seen the movie, because those are two drastically different answers.
Right.
With a shadow cast, so the first time I saw it with the shadow cast, I was 16 years old. And so probably like somewhere between 20 and 30 times with a shadow cast.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. That's a commitment.
Well, think about it. Like, once a year for the past 20 years, about roughly. And sometimes I would go maybe two or three times a year, and maybe I haven't gone in a couple of years. So like that's a huge guesstimate. But just seeing the movie probably over 100 times.
Was or is there any ritual to your rewatching it? Lay the table here for me. I'm very curious.
All right. So my freshman year in college, my roommates, we had like a quad style dorm. So there were four of us in sharing space. They also loved Rocky Horror Picture Show. So we would watch it on Sundays. It was kind of like our little Sunday ritual. We would hang out, sit around. We would watch the Rocky Horror Picture Show with the call lines. And it kind of became a thing with our friend group where we would all get together and watch Rocky Horror. And if it wasn't, I feel like it was like every single Sunday for months, but it might not have been that frequently. It just feels like that. But I'm pretty sure like for at least 6 months, we would watch it at least twice a month with the call lines. So it's like things like that, which is kind of like, if I've seen at least 20 live showings and I watched it that frequently in college, plus other times throughout my life.
You've seen this thing a whole bunch of times. Yeah.
I can totally see why. Like I was watching it last night, and I haven't watched it since the last Shadowcast show I went to, which was in 2011 or 12.
Yeah.
And it just brought me right back. You know, I was asking myself like, why the fuck haven't you watched this in so long? You idiot. It's such a joy to watch Frankenfurter strut. Like, that's all I need in my life is Tim Curry strutting across the screen. It's so good.
So what I did last year for New Year's Eve, so I recently left restaurants and started working for a fantastic wine import company. So last New Year's Eve was the first New Year's Eve in at least a decade that I have not worked. Fun facts, if you start the Rocky Horror Picture Show at about 11:40 p.m., you'll be doing the time warp when the clock hits midnight.
Perfect.
One of the more memorable times that I've put the movie on at home was last New Year's Eve. It's like I was by myself, exactly what I wanted. I didn't want to be around people. I didn't want to be a part of the party. I was by myself. I had a bottle of champagne, probably Delamotte, an ounce of caviar, and the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
That sounds like a great New Year's Eve.
Top notch. So fucking good.
And after Tim Curry's entrance with Sweet Transvestite, I turned everything off and went to bed. It was great.
Yeah.
Well done.
Speaking of the time warp. So the Susan Sarandon and Barry Bostwick characters to me are the strangest characters in the entire movie. Everyone else emotionally makes much more sense to me as recognizable human beings. They walk into this weird castle. All right, so Riff Raff gives them like the, you know, Igor treatment. The master is coming down. Yeah. They walk into the ballroom and everyone breaks out into a song and dance number. And Janet just starts fainting over and over again. Janet, you are already in a musical number. You already had two songs. Why are you so shocked that people are dancing? They're not even being particularly suggestive with the song. Like, all right, they talk about like a pelvic thrust, but everyone's still got their clothes on. What are you so upset about,
Scott, Janet? The pelvic thrust really drives you in, say, yay, 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 yay.
Obviously. Well, I think that has to do with how... like how this movie was received and what Brad and Janet like represent. So Brad and Janet, like through the course of this movie, they start off incredibly chaste. They're trapped by the social norms. And let's look at when this was really released, right? In the 70s. So they're kind of the embodiment of what the social norms were. And here they go. They entered into this incredibly flamboyant party. And yeah, okay, it's just people that are dancing, but it's still a very flamboyant thing that they're seeing. And Frankenfurter hasn't even entered yet.
Yeah.
And she's she's tired and she's in shock. And what's going on? They just saw this motorcyclist come from wherever and they're going to this strange castle. Castles don't have phones, asshole. You know, like.
I'm on board with her fainting. If she starts fainting at the reveal of Frankenfurter, makes perfect sense to me because she's super buttoned up and she's clearly still a virgin and his like overt, like palpating, that's the wrong word to use, but his overt sexuality
I think palpating is the correct word to use.
He's doing some palpating when the two of them get together in her, in her bedroom later on. But yeah, like if that's when she started fainting, totally get it. But like just at like a bunch of like very like nicely and colorfully dressed people like doing a song and dance number, like I don't know, Janet, what movie did you think you were in here? And the then fucking Brad, who was like, well, we're just gonna go along with all of it until they let us use the phone. It's okay, let them take all of your clothes off and we'll get into our underwear. And then the moment they get upstairs, he immediately switches off and turns into a complete asshole and starts shouting and he's offended by Frankenfurter. And it's like, man, I don't understand who you are as a person. You change, like both of them, they're constantly changing, but it's okay because halfway through the movie, once Frankenfurter fucks both of them, they really stop being important and they're not really in the movie anymore.
Fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess maybe her fainting at the beginning was just to amp up that like chaste social, like, whatever the social norms were back in the 70s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
I think it was just a thing for Susan Sarandon to do.
Major juxtaposition.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's also like it's 75. Like these guys survived. Like they came through the late 60s. They would have been like in high school probably, like in around the time of Woodstock. Like they would have seen, you know, hippies and free love and the counterculture movement. They obviously missed all of that.
Well, obviously. They're not a liberated place.
No.
Not until Frankenfurter gets a hold of them.
Wow.
I think that Brad and Janet are very, very out of place. I was on this repeat viewing, really, I don't know what the correct word is. the American Gothic duo in the beginning that are just parroting their lines, that are the backup singers for Damn It, Janet.
So you mean Fantastic Frankenfurter, song. Riff Raff, and Columbia? No, it's Magenta. Yeah, they are.
Oh, it's them.
It's Tim Curry and are American Richard Gothic. O'Brien. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, like, why are they there? Why are they dressed as American Gothic? What Shits are they doing? Like, what's going on?
Shits and gigs.
I think that ties into what Steph is talking about, right? Like that's where Brad and Janet come from. They come from, like, heartland, wholesome Americana. I don't think they're meant to be playing the same characters. It's probably just a holdover from the stage show when people would play multiple characters and then switch costumes between act breaks.
And it makes for, like, a great call line in the movie, because when you've seen it and you see these three characters in the background at the church, like, the call line is, you know, hey, we see you, Riff, but the virgins don't.
Do you have a favorite callback from all the many live shadow casts you've gone to?
Oh, absolutely. My two favorites are, so when Rocky comes out of the tank and Frankenfurter is asking everyone, oh, hey, what do you think about him? Riff Raff is like, oh, he's wonderful. He's amazing. Magenta, he's a triumph of your success. Columbia, she rests her arms on the side of the tank. She goes, he's okay. When Frankenfurter, right before Frankenfurter hits the side of the tank, the calling is, bitch, get your tits off my tank. And she pops up and gets her tits off the tank. My second favorite is when Janet Weiss finds, after Rocky's been released and he's running around and he's being chased by the hounds, Janet finds him whimpering back in the creation room, whatever, Frank's laboratory, whatever you want to call it. And she's like, oh no, you're hurt. And she rips her slip. Oh, look, it's Susan Saran Wrap. She's got more hurt than you've got skirt.
Yes.
That's pretty sweaty, but I like it anyway.
Jimmy, you like that Susan Saran Wrap?
Susan Saran
Wrap. I do. I like it.
I also just like Susan Sarandon. But
Susan Sarandon's great.
Yeah, she's great in the
wonderful
movie. Also, total babe in the movie. Still now, love Susan Sarandon.
Still at 77 years old, yep. A total babe.
She's a fine-looking woman. Yeah, whenever she shows up in anything, my son is always like, oh, it's Speed Racer's mom. I'm like, yep, yes. That is Speed Racer's mom. Exactly.
Mom racer.
Mom's racer. Can't make a peanut butter jelly sandwich to save her life, but man, that woman makes me cry every time I watch Speed Racer. I ask about the callbacks. The only one that I remember, and it's from when we went and saw the live stage show, and it was a callback that in, like, I don't know, a 500 seat house with, like, a huge balcony, that my wife was the only one who shouted out this callback confidently and loudly. I might be remembering wrong, but I feel like she stood up and pointed at the stage and shouted out, which is in, it's a Tim Curry song. It's Frankenfurter's last number, and he's something, and it clung to her thigh, or it clung to your thigh. And my wife stands up and shouts out, like a homesick abortion, to, like, pin drops in the theater. And
that one's so good. As it clung to her thigh, like a homesick abortion, and I started to cry. Well, you'd cry too if you were a homesick abortion.
That's a classic moment. What, Steph, if any, memories or feelings or places or people or times in your life does watching this movie evoke and bring you back to?
I have a lot of answers to this question.
Let's hear them.
Emotions are pure joy, just joy. That's that very short answer. Places that I think about with this movie. Movie theaters, because you go to a movie theater and you see, that's where they project it in. There's the shadow cast. So these movie theaters are in Cocoa Beach, Orlando, New York City, my dorm room when I was in school in Charlotte. People that I really think about with this movie are my best friend, Laura Marie Watson, who I went to when I was six, when we were 16 years old. We went to see this movie, this live showing, and she is one of my absolute favorite human beings on this planet. I would do absolutely anything for her. One of my really good friends from college, Molly, when she came, this is years ago, I haven't seen her in years, but when she came with her husband and their daughter. Her husband's like, here, you two take my credit card and we're going to go out. We went out, we had dinner. Then we ended up going to record a picture show and like going out dancing afterwards. And this is one of the people in college that I would sit and watch the Rocky Horror Picture Show with. And now like also my friend Shannon, who is one of the most important human beings in my life. She loves Rocky Horror Picture Show too. And it's just like this community and friendship. Like I just, there are so many people. And if you want to talk about times, like this movie, this experience has been part of my life for 20 years. That's over half of my life right now. It surpasses time for me. This movie is a part of me and my memories and who I am. And it's the fucking best.
That's lovely. As someone who like, obviously like I deeply love the movies, but also like theatrical experiences. Like that is the one thing about Rocky Horror that even apparently having never seen it before, that it was always like one of those special things that brought people out together, even if, and I don't mean to disparage you or anybody else who goes out to a Rocky Horror Shadowcast show, but largely from my experience and from the experience of other theater people that I've talked to, those audiences fucking destroy theaters every single time.
Yes, absolutely.
For a lot of independent and art house theaters over the decades, Rocky Horror helped them keep the doors open. Like doing Rocky Horror Friday night once a month or even like every week for some theaters helped pay the bills so they could pay their staff and keep their screens open and show like art house movies and French movies and little tiny indie movies to, you know, old people for matinees and nobody else. So like, I love Rocky Horror for that, but also like they fucking destroy the theaters. Like there were theaters that I would go to. If you're ever in a movie theater and you see like weird stains on the screen, like, oh, that's clearly ketchup up there. There was Rocky Horror in that theater within the last few weeks. And they just haven't gotten the time to grab a 25-foot ladder to go up and clean the ketchup stain off the top of the screen. But it is special, man.
I think the last showing that I went to, I did not bring any props. That for those who are not familiar with Rocky Horror Picture Show, and props are like a huge thing. And I know a lot of theaters and troupes, at least now, they're very specific about what you can and cannot do.
Yeah.
But like, let's make the cleanup easier. We don't want to destroy the theater. Let's like respect the place. So it's significantly better now than it was 20 years ago when I started going.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad for that, but I do want it to like continue happening. Cause like, you know, movie theaters are at kind of, as they have been for a while, at this crisis like point, and anything that can help keep the doors open and keep people coming in and realizing, like you've been talking about, what a communal experience it is. Like that's valuable. And we got to figure out a way to make it keep happening.
Yeah.
All right. You already touched on physical media. You have a DVD of Rocky Horror. Is that your only physical media history with it? Did you have the VHS? It's just one DVD. Okay.
I just have the DVD. That's it.
Yeah. Do you watch it like on your own from time to time, or do you mostly stick to the Shadowcast experience?
At this point, I mostly stick to Shadowcast experience, or like special occasions, like, you know, like New Year's Eve, I just want to be by myself and I'll put on Rocky Horror. Or if someone who has seen it and is a fan like I am, like, it's like, oh, let's just put this on. And but we all so end up like sitting around and just talking and hanging out and not really paying attention to the movie. It can kind of turn into white noise for me on that note.
Well, I mean, it's a great musical. There's so many good songs. Like it's just like putting a record on, but then, you know, there's like all these beautiful, strangely clad bodies on screen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everybody in this movie is so hot. That was
right.
Speaking of beautiful and strangely clad, like Jesus Christ.
Yo.
Shit.
Barry Bostwick. I think they must have been like custom tidy whities. He has them pulled up awfully high, I think, to exaggerate how much of a bulge they're generating. But even Barry Bostwick being absolutely absurd. There's a bunch of very attractive people in this movie.
I mean, Peter Hinwood as Rocky.
Yeah.
Just
not a good performance,
but just shred it up.
I mean, the movie's not supposed to be good. It's a at best B-rated sci-fi horror flick. make fun of sci-fi horror. Like, at best, it's B-rated parody genre.
The funny thing about it, though, is like we were talking before about the Tim Curry performance.
Yeah,
like having that truly iconic, bombastic, spectacular performance next to Peter Hinwood, who is doing nothing but standing.
He has a terrific body, and that's all he's got. He's got a terrific body and a Prince Valiant wig to make his head look more like a penis, and that's all he's got.
And it's exactly what the movie needs, because like he's Frankenfurter's monster or whatever, and he's just there to for sex. That's why Frankenfurter made him.
Yeah.
But exactly. Also, like, it's an incredible disparity watching the two of them next to one another.
Yeah, I think he's the only bad performance in the movie. I think everybody else is fantastic and does, like, exactly what is asked of them, you know? Okay, Steph, what was the thing in Rocky Horror that you loved the most when you first saw it? And what is the thing about it that you love the most now?
Okay, so when I first saw it, probably just how much fun it was and how much fun everyone was having. The music, the dancing, and the costumes, like, people dress up for this and like pull out a lot of costumes and sequence, and it's amazing and beautiful. And that part hasn't changed. I love the dressing up and figuring out like, oh, how am I gonna like cosplay Janet, or I can do Brad. Like, if I had the money to invest in the amount of sequins that it would take to become Columbia, I would. But oh my gosh,
with the gold sequins that she has all over.
Oh my god, exactly. Oh my god, and like none of that has changed. What I love about it now, it's just, we've said this a lot, that like the community, the communal aspect of it, and how much of like a safe space it is to find a way to just be yourself and express yourself. This movie, you know, it came out in the 70s. This movie made it okay for, or it started to make it okay for a lot of that.
Yeah, but like it's, like I was saying before, like if I had seen it 20 years ago, I would have been scandalized by so much. And watching it now, and just the way the world has changed and my eyes have been opened, and it's just like, oh, this is just all positive, and nothing about it feels like it's transgressive because this movie opened up so many doors for so many people.
Right. And I think just like if we look at when the movie was released in 1975, it didn't have a positive reception. But that's because there was like how Brad and Janet, who are supposed to, I guess, be our protagonists. I personally don't think there's a villain or a protagonist in this movie. It's just a storyline that doesn't make a lot of sense, and it doesn't really go anywhere, and nothing matters. It's just a bunch of scantily clad people having a great time. But everything that's happening in this movie is also not in alignment with what was happening. Well, maybe it is in alignment with what was happening in the US at the time, but it goes against all the social norms, which all the revolutions were going against.
It's in alignment with, you know, with the zeitgeist of a lot of youth, but it certainly was not in alignment with the wider American norms of the time.
There you go.
And it was transgressive in the 70s, and it's one of the reasons why I'm sure my mother latched onto it back then and showed it to me, because she wanted me to be acclimatized to things like that. Scott and I talk about the horrible state of the world a lot, both on and off mic. And sometimes we feel, you know, like things are crashing down around us, but this is a great example of actual measurable progress. Because you're right, Scott, this rewatch didn't feel at all transgressive. It didn't feel at all like it was skirting the edge. It felt proper and mainstream and joyful.
Yeah.
It felt like just people being happy, and these people are doing normal things.
Yeah.
Aside from like when they're aliens, I guess. But that's a whole other, you know, it's a science fiction picture show, not a double feature.
It sure
is. It's not a double feature at all.
No, Jamie, I'm glad you have finally learned that lesson. It is not a double feature. It is one movie.
One movie. One movie.
They tried to do it as a double feature. So I was doing a little bit of digging, because I knew like the apocryphal stories, but I had to look into it. So the arc of this movie is fascinating. The London production, the stage show, ran uninterrupted for 7 years. They bring it to the US contiguous with that, or concurrent with that. There's an LA production that's very successful for 9 months. They bring it to Broadway. It does previews and shutters after 45 performances. The movie was already in the works. The movie flopped so hard that it opened in LA where it did okay. They try to expand it to a few cities. It doesn't even open New York City in its initial run, but Fox was desperate. There was a marketing guy there. God, I forget the guy's name. Who was trying to push the boulder up the hill, trying to make this movie a thing. Fox fired him twice and they kept rehiring him because like he kept having these incidental successes with the movie. They did it as a double feature with the 1974 Brian De Palma rock opera musical Phantom of the Paradise. Have you ever seen this? Crazy bananas. Like Brian De Palma known for like Hitchcock pastiche, like, you know, horned up like suspense thrillers, but then he also does this bananas like rock opera musical. Jamie, it's on Criterion Channel if you still have my login.
I think I do, yes.
What's that called?
The Phantom of the Paradise, yeah.
I'm going to watch that.
They try and release it as a double feature with that, which doesn't really do any business, but then they just notice that like some of the theaters that are running it at midnight just because they were already open were seeing audiences come out. So this Fox marketing exec convinces everybody, like, let's push the midnight thing and let's stress it. And by 1976, it was already becoming a cult hit. The movie that flopped on its initial release has never not been in U.S. theaters since 1975. It has made $115 million for a movie that flopped, and it has never not been playing in a U.S. theater since it came out. I was reading a New York Times piece that was written for the 40th anniversary, or maybe the 45th anniversary, they were saying that even now, like on average, roughly 75 theaters in the States show the movie every week. Like it is just going anywhere. Yeah. For something that died hard when it first came out.
It's community. This movie is community for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's special. It's... Things like this don't really happen too much anymore. That's why something like the Barbenheimer phenomenon of this summer was like so special to like movie theater people, like movies. It was like, oh, like people are coming out and they're like, I did the double feature Barbie Oppenheimer and there were people in costumes at both of them. There were people dressed up as Robert Oppenheimer, for Christ's sakes, at like a matinee at my local IMAX. And then, you know, a ton of Barbie people at the sold out show afterwards. So like more things like that, more things that people respond to.
Yes.
How has your relationship to the movie changed since you first saw it? I as an alternate, if that's a weird question, because it is for most people, if you could describe your relationship to the movie as though you were describing a relationship to a friend, how do you think it may have changed over time?
I don't know how to answer that.
That's okay.
My relationship with that movie changed?
Well, like, for example,
it's just bringing community and people together, and it's just fun. And as we've said, like, especially now in 2023, there's nothing perverse about it. It's just a bunch of people singing, dancing, having a good time for the most part.
Murdering meatloaf is pretty perverse.
Yeah. I mean, there's there's cannibalism. Like, what else do you want out of a B-rated horror flick?
Ooh, I forgot about that.
Ooh, sorry.
That's a good line. Tender subject. Oof. Ooh, great line.
Brad gets it. Janet gets it. Rocky gets it, but he'll eat anyone.
But he'll keep going. All right. Final question. What things from the movie do you carry with you in everyday life? This can be things like favorite lines or lyrics or just ideas from the movie or music cues or references or merch. Do you have any merch? Like, how does this movie revisit itself upon you?
So we've touched on community a lot. So that's obvious at this point. I feel like this movie is also a lot about being authentic and being yourself and finding ways to liberate yourself from things that might be holding you back. Self-expression, being your authentic self and being unapologetic about being your authentic self. If we want to talk about cues and lines, like this, I started this movie with live showings. I'm all about the call lines and music and cues for this. So whenever I hear someone be like, I would like, I just start thinking about the criminologist's entrance in the movie. I would like, oh, you would, wouldn't you, to take you. Oh, take me on a strange journey. How strange was it? So strange, they made a movie out of it. Like I can't with it. So now that we've all seen the introductory scene to the Rocky Horror Picture Show from my mouth,
that character is so insane. Jamie, did you notice the pictures that he had on his desk? He has two framed portraits on his desk.
No.
He has a framed portrait of Nixon.
Oh my
and
God.
A framed portrait of seemingly a very young Ronald Reagan, like a definitely pre-presidency, maybe even like 1950s and 60s, like movie star era Ronald Reagan. I'm pretty sure that was the second one.
I'm gonna have to watch this movie again to confirm this.
Also, yeah, if it's Ronald Reagan, he was not in office at this point.
That's what I'm saying. It's definitely pre-presidency, but I don't know if he was like the governor of California or whatnot, but he looked young in this one picture.
He would have had to be the governor, yeah. Wild. That's fucking wild.
Tells you an awful lot about that character.
Yes, it does.
Jamie, do you have anything else you would like to share about Rocky Horror before we wrap up and I go do bedtime?
I mean, it's a fucking delight. It's not as much a part of my molecular makeup as it is of Steph's. But I do associate it with warm emotions regarding my mother, because she was a Rocky Horror fanatic. I've been to, you know, a number of shadow performances or shadow cast performances, and I now, having been reinvigorated, can't wait until I go to the next one.
Oh, man, that would have been cool to go to one of those with Sharon. That would have been formative.
I wish that I had.
That would have been very cool. All right, quickly, Jamie. Favorite song, go.
Ooh. I mean, it's got to be Meatloaf's song, right? It has to be.
That's my answer as well. I like the song.
Oh my God.
I like saxophones. I like people riding motorcycles indoors. Like that number rules for me.
Yeah, but also The Time Warp, and also Sweet Transsexual, and also Touch Me. And also like
Sweet Transvestite, not Sweet Transsexual.
Yeah, yeah, Jamie. Planet is transvestite. The galaxy is transsexual. All right, learn your geography.
God, and you call yourself a wine professional. God. Oh,
you don't even know what appellation they're from.
I want wine from transvestite, please.
Steph, what about you? Do you have a favorite number in the movie?
As much as I love Hot Patootie, I'm going with Rose Tint My World.
Mm.
So I just saw the thing this morning. I don't know the names of all the songs. Which one is that? Who sings that song?
It's the full cast, and the whole number is quite long. It's when they do the floor show, and it starts
the floor
off
show.
When they're,
okay.
Yeah,
when they're marble statues.
When they're marble statues, and Frankenfurter flips the switch, and they all come out of whatever trance that they're in.
And then they end up
That's
in a pool.
That's the start of it. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that one's outstanding. That's great.
The number is spectacular.
Yeah,
the number is really the costumes, mm-hmm. like that's the pinnacle of the costumes for the show.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
What a good time.
Peter Henwood, I'm just 7 hours old. Like, oh my gosh, it's so good. Really beautiful to behold.
I'll say, like, having now like properly seen the thing, and it was like 20 minutes in when I realized, like, oh, I've never seen this movie before. I absorbed a lot of it through osmosis and seeing the live version, but I've absolutely not seen this before. Having now seen it, I don't ever want to watch it again by myself. I only want to do a shadow cast with an audience and feel that energy. Like that's the experience that you want.
That's the experience. That is, for me, the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for making me watch this. I thought I had, but I hadn't. And this was a wonderful excuse. Thank you. This was great.
Hey.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing your history with the movie. This is you have a real like arc with it. And it was a lovely experience to share that with you.
You're so welcome.
Do we think this paired with any of our wines? Right? Yes. Bubbles, celebration, fun, froth.
Absolutely.
Frivolity. Yeah.
I think if I had opened this wine with reckless abandon and let the cork go wherever, that would be a better pair than the like controlled opening that I did. Or like sabering the wine or whatever. But yeah, sparkling wine is perfect for this movie.
Sabering the wine would have been a much more appropriate way to open the wine for this movie, for, I think, obvious reasons. But sparkling wine in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Absolutely.
Well, they even drank sparkling at some point. Somebody opens what looked like a bottle of Veuve, right? I thought I saw.
Yeah, yeah. Frankenfurter has a bottle of Veuve.
Yeah. See, I know.
Riffraff drops labels. It before going up the elevator.
You're off book. You know this thing front and back. It's perfect.
20 years, Scotty.
Hey, yay, yay.
Dr. Scott.
Oh, yeah, there he is. Ugh. Well, I was looking for a Halloween costume.
That would be a good one. That would be a real good one.
I just need to get a wheelchair. All right, James, land the plane.
Landing the plane. Thank you, Steph, for coming on this journey with us. Thank you, everyone else, for joining us. Please follow us on the socials at BiggerBottlePod or email us at BiggerBottlePod@gmail.com. You can tell us what your favorite comfort food movies and beverages are. You could also tag us in a post or DM us if you'd like. Make sure, if you like the show, to rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our art is by Ross Connor. Thank you very much, Ross. And also thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with social media and project management.
Remember, everyone, drink more sparkling wine and go to a damn midnight showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
But don't make a mess.
Be conscious of the people that work in the place. It's good for you, we promise.
It really is good for you.
The flip side of the being busy coin and work feeling good is that I'm tired.
You're very tired. Oh, you're very you're sleepy. Tired. You need a nap.
I'm an eepy
you're
little
sleepy.
Guy.
Oh, sleepy buddy. Little baby.
Oh, you got little bags under your eyes. Oh,
I'm so sleepy,
Oh, you need to get a pillow. This is all going in the episode, by the way. This is good.